Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Sally Elcordi, and welcome to Public Advocate. Today, I have two guests on my show. I have asked them to come on to talk about the dangers of the flu shot, which has recently been mandated for 6 months through 5 years in New York City for children attending daycare, preschool, and kindergarten. This is a dangerous shot, as will be put forth by my guests. We certainly have done our level best to educate the people at the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene in New York City, as well as the mayor. I have called 311 and left a message, which was never responded to. I have emailed him, and I have written him a letter. I have also started a petition to ban vaccines due to the noxious, poisonous, toxic ingredients within them, and none of this has worked. People have protested. We have spoken out with volumes of information, all of which was completely ignored. Truly, it was ignored. So they have made a decision based on the responses of one doctor to all of these comments and entrusted him 1,000%, regardless of all the information that opposes everything he said in this meeting. So this is really ludicrous that this has passed. Really, it's amazing that all of these people at the meeting, they were all doctors, one lawyer, voted to mandate this for the children. Now, mind you, I cannot speak about targeting children without your full understanding of the fact that to give a shot to a child is far more devastating to the system of the child than it is to an adult. So even though 23 seniors recently died from flu inoculations, it is actually far more dangerous to give it to little people. Dr. Paul Haley, a chemist, has said that one shot to a 6-pound infant is the equivalent of 30 shots to a 180-pound adult on the same day. I am beyond concerned. I know this will be devastating to these little itty-bitty people, and no matter how much proof we present, they continue. I wrote back. My guest, Eileen Daneman, is on. I'm delighted to pick her up. Just give me 1 second, please, while I do that. Hello, is this Eileen Daneman?
Yes, hello.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you for calling in, Eileen. I'm going to introduce you in a proper fashion. Eileen Daneman is the founder of the Student Vaccine Liberation Army and the director of the National Council of Organized Women. And how long have you been doing both of those things, Eileen?
Well, I started with the National Coalition of Organized Women in the 90s when it was about the depleted uranium in Iran, and then it was about the mercury in the vaccines. And then I started the Student Vaccine Liberation Army probably about 5 years ago when I realized that this one kid in Minnesota, his name was Robert Wanick. He was 16 years old. He brought to school his own vaccine information statement showing the risks of vaccines, and he plastered it on his bathroom wall in the school and started handing it out. And eventually he was thrown out of school and he sued and all that kind of stuff. But I realized that it only takes one student per school to blow the whistle on this thing. So I called him, and basically he says kids don't want brochures. It's a high-tech world. They love stickers. They've been collecting stickers since they were babies. And so I started the name came to me, the Student Vaccine Liberation Army, because it's a positive statement about liberation, not a resistance statement. And he informed me about the stickers. And then this very famous artist, David D., he did the illustration, the logo with the skulls and the crossbones. And the kids just, I mean, I just walk the street. I appear at a school. We have people all over the country, matter of fact, all over the different nations, just handing out these stickers. We give free rolls of stickers, 250 stickers, and they just, you know, unroll them, and you say to the kids, hey, do you want a free sticker? Well, the skull and the crossbones is so dynamic that they actually ask for, can I have 10? Can I have 20? You're never rejected, basically, virtually never rejected. So we figure that the students are more flexible. They're they're the ones that humanity has been waiting for. They're the ones that have been affected by the vaccines. They're the ones who don't want vaccines. So we target the middle school and the high school and the college students.
Yes, so, and I have to tell you that people came back to me this year just to get your stickers. Mm-hmm. We were thrilled. And the year prior, they came to get the stickers to show their parents. These stickers are very welcome. Indeed, they are. I think only one child in the history of children has said, oh, you don't have candy? You know, only one kid. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm talking about giving out hundreds of them. So,
well, you know, the kids are going to teach the parents. That's the thing, because the parents look at the sticker and they think, well, I gotta check this out because I don't want my kid to have a sticker that looks so, you know, kind of diabolical in a sense, you know, with the skull and crossbone. So the parents are compelled to, like, check it out. And so when they check it out, they find out, whoa, look what's going on.
Well, it's ingenious all around, and you are an incredibly wise and creative woman. And certainly Robert Wanick, we gave him the Responsibility in Reporting Award a few years ago for his work at the clinics to inject the
right.
H1N1 flu shot into pregnant women. He was the winner of the Responsibility mm-hmm. in Reporting Award for that. So, because it was activism along with reporting, which is really
valuable. What an amazing guy, right? I mean, he actually, when you think about it, Robert Wanick, at the age of 16, on his own accord, actually, you could say, started this movement that I'm, you know, involved in, and also on his own accord did that with the pregnant women and all that. I mean, this is an amazing guy.
He was 15 when he did that.
Oh, amazing guy.
Isn't that? Well, I've been trying to interview him now for quite a while, but he's really busy. He's, I think he was a reporter on Alex Jones for a while. I could be mistaken about that. But he's always up to something and always for, you know, exposing the New World Order. And he's brave, he's smart, and he's effective. So, yeah,
yep.
what a cool guy. But anyway,
yeah.
In fact, he's the poster child for activism, as far as I am concerned. There's nobody else who's even approached his level of effectiveness. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Beyond that, Eileen, I would like you, if you would, because this is such an important study, talk about the H1N1 flu shot and pregnant women.
Okay, so we've gotten some new information lately. Actually, Dr. Goldman, who did study with us about we followed pregnant women in the 2009/10 faux H1N1 pandemic, where they were experimenting with pregnant women by giving them the untested H1N1 vaccine. And so just by the luck of the draw, you know, we started following them, the pregnant women, and they started to communicate via the Internet. And a website called Organic Health was getting a lot of hits about that. And so we hooked up with them, and we got we put out a public service announcement asking pregnant women to contact us. And at the same time, we were looking at the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. Now, the Vaccine Adverse Reporting System, Adverse Events Reporting System, is the basic main government reporting system that by law in 1986, when they established the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, by law, the doctors are supposed to report to Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System any associative problems with vaccines. And so, unfortunately, it's there was no penalty for not reporting, so unfortunately, it is about 1% of reporting, so it's like 99% non-reported. So it's kind of relative. So, but relatively, you can see from year to year whether there's a signal that something is going wrong because it's all relative. So it doesn't matter that it's 99% ineffective, I mean, and not reported. It matters relative to the year before, and it's still 99% unreported. So we started following that early on, and it turned out that there was a 4,250% spike in miscarriages and stillbirths during the H1N1 pandemic. And we found that out, you know, early on in the 3, 4, 5 months, the beginning of the season. And as a matter of fact, I actually was on a phone call in Washington. They were having a public phone call. And Marie McCormick, Dr. Marie McCormick, who was the head of the Vaccine Safety Risk and Assessment Working Group that was established especially during the pandemic so that if anything was signaled, they would immediately know. And this is the group that was in charge, Dr. Marie McCormick. Now, Dr. Marie McCormick was the one years ago that said we will never connect vaccines with autism during the Bruce Stratton thing. So she's really in there. So anyway, I actually was on the phone with this whole group, and she was on the phone, and I mentioned we must follow the pregnant women since we're giving them this untested vaccine. And the person who was in charge of the telephone conversation actually said to Marie McCormick, make sure we follow the pregnant women. Anyway, so what happened is that we're following pregnant women, and we find a really, really big signal, like couple of thousand to one signal that they're occurring miscarriages and stillbirths. So meanwhile, the CDC does not notify the nation's OBGYNs as they promised to do. And this is a huge signal. Guillain-Barré was like a 3% signal, and they were a little concerned about that. Some thrombosis type of ailment was a little bit of a signal. They were concerned about that. But meanwhile, this they did not report. In other words, somehow the CDC made sure that they weren't looking in VAERS. They looked in VAERS for everything else but not the pregnancies, and because I assume that they knew about it, but they didn't want to destroy the vaccine program, because if they had called the nation's OBGYNs and say, hey, you know, halt or make your decision to stop this because we're already there's a huge signal that this is causing miscarriages. They didn't do that. And so at the end of the year, all the research, all the VAERS reports were in. And so National Coalition of Organized Women made a presentation in Washington, D.C. to the vaccine establishment. And at that time, Dr. Marie McCormick was on the phone making a presentation. And after the commissioners, all the 18 committee members, knew of our statistics, which showed a 4,250% increase in miscarriages, then McCormick got on the air, and she didn't know about, you know, this presentation. And she was asked by one of the committee members who had seen my papers, said to her, were there any adverse events for pregnant women? Well, Dr. Marie McCormick, the head of this committee, said, no, no adverse events for pregnant women. So somehow she lied. She didn't know. They didn't follow the VAERS. It was all very, very strange. And then when we blew the whistle on them, they eventually corroborated that we were absolutely right. But what they did was which was a terrible thing. What they did was they had a collusive relationship with the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which is an Elsevier magazine, and they actually published a study by the CDC that basically was a foundation that the flu shot is safe for pregnant women. But what it was this Dr. Morrow from the CDC and AJOG published a study that showed from 1991 to 2009, which we all assume was the pandemic, that there was only 1.2% miscarriages per year, 20 miscarriages in like 19 years, and that there was like no problem. Well, it turned out that the 2009 he was reporting was the 2008/2009 season, the season before the pandemic. And so the CDC purposely did not put the pandemic in the study, which was what everybody was waiting for. And they actually entitled it from 1991 to 2009, making the OBGYNs think that this was the 2009 pandemic, and it wasn't. And so they didn't report the 4,250% increase. They reported that the flu shot is safe for pregnant women, which went worldwide publicity. And I have all the documentation that it was all happening in October, September, August, and November. It was a complete collusive relationship. And then the nonprofits, we're talking about the March of Dimes, they along with the CDC and the Epidemic Intelligence Service, do a joint letter of 10 nonprofits saying that the OBGYN, targeting the OBGYNs with a private letter to all the OBGYNs in the nation saying, continue to give the vaccine to pregnant women, but we're only going to give one. And they didn't say, because we just found out that we had a 4,250% spike in miscarriages. No, they didn't mention that. They just said, oh, just do one. Well, what had really happened is that the CDC during the pandemic gave our pregnant women two shots, a double dose, the seasonal vaccine with thimerosal in it and the H1N1, double dose them in any trimester with 50 mcgs of thimerosal. And nobody knows about it, which leads me to this fellow in Utah. Okay, there's this Dr. David Blodgett, who is the director of the Southwest Utah Department of Health. Well, several years ago, right when the Gardasil thing was up, the HPV vaccine, he made a stand not to stock Gardasil at the Southwest Utah Health Department. Well, as time flies with all the stuff about Gardasil and the controversy, again this arises, and he refuses to stock Gardasil because it's not based on science. Well, right now we've written thank you notes to Dr. Blodgett, and we've gotten back from different people who've written him. His career is really on the line right now. So basically. He wrote back to me and said when I thanked him for everything he was doing, he wrote back to me and said, unfortunately, there is no open, I have it written down here. He says, unfortunately, there's no open dialogue about these vaccines. And he wrote to another gal on our network that his career, it's a lonely place right now for him in his career. So basically, I wrote back to him and said that all of us in the vaccine movement here, you know, will just support him, that we have a wide range of vaccine consultants and activists that are available to him pro bono. We can provide any support that he needs for any future stand if he keeps his job. Any studies regarding the safety of individual vaccines and the cost effectiveness to the state of Utah, for example, and so I urged him as a strategist, which I am, that this is the position he should take. This guy is like a Goliath. This guy is like a David and Goliath. Okay, I mean, he's probably going to lose his job if he keeps his moral course. So I told him that this is a position he needs to take. The Utah Department of Health, under his directorship, is primarily concerned with protecting the health of Utah residents. Programs and vaccines suggested by the CDC, the ACIP, from a national perspective, are not to be simply accepted routinely and without analysis from the state level. After all, the state health departments are not solely long arms of the CDC implementing national intention. It is the job of individual state departments of health to respond to concerns of their residents and to evaluate national mandates and recommendations, performing another step in the safety step in the process of protecting Utah residents in specific. Every state department should be that way. So I'm hoping that he's going to be left standing. If he's left standing, we have a light that's shining in Utah.
Yes, we do, and I have a recommendation because somebody sent me a petition saying thank the mayor of a city in Hawaii, Billy Kanoi, for banning GMOs. I think possibly we should do the same thing by creating a petition to thank this man. What is his name again?
Dr. David Blodgett.
We should do a petition thanking him, and everybody can say why they thank him. So I believe
we should do something like if he responds to me, like we know that he's employed by the state, right? So somebody's employing him, and he looks like he could possibly be fired, right? So I think what we really need to do is, if he responds, to find out who hires and fires him. And this was my suggestion to him. During that H1 pandemic of the pregnant women, the Utah OBGYNs, okay, did not know about this 4,250% increase. So I asked him, Dr. David Blodgett, by the way, since you're the health director of the Southwest Utah Health Department, did you know that there was a 4,250% increase in miscarriage and stillbirths during the 2009 pandemic? Did the CDC inform you about that? He says, no. So I said, well, you know, if you're the director of the health department and you weren't informed about it, think about all the OBGYNs in Utah that were not informed about it, and they were actually continuing to inject their patients and basically committing unwitting aborted protocol. In other words, by not notifying the OBGYNs in Utah of the incoming statistics right as it is happening, they are unwittingly continuing this aborted protocol, and they probably don't know it. So my suggestion is that he's going to need the Utah physicians on his side. So to get the Utah physicians on his side, I'm suggesting that with him, hopefully while he has a job, that we do a survey. So we get all the names of the Utah physicians, and we do a survey, you know, of did the CDC tell them that on the fly, at real time, that these vaccines were aborting babies. Now, I think that the OBGYNs will be pretty pissed at that and will want to support Dr. David Blodgett. I also said to Dr. David Blodgett that all the pediatricians, you know, are not aware of this either. The pediatricians in Utah, if they were aware that how about the survivors? I mean, if a double dose killed so many babies, the ones that survived, they could be very damaged, and that won't come out until like 2-3 year olds. And so the pediatricians are not even aware when somebody comes in with symptoms that this is what happened to them in utero. And so I'm thinking that we get the physicians of Utah behind this man, and because congratulations to him by petition is not really going to do anything. You know, it's just going to make him feel better. But
okay,
we can do, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that sounds good. I want to say something in support of everything you just said regarding the flu shot in pregnant women. There was an article back in October of 2009 about should you or should you not take the H1N1 swine flu, and I just want to read to you four of the first comments that were written under this article. This totally backs up what you're saying, and they're short. One of them is, I got both vaccines on Thursday. I was 9 weeks pregnant. I miscarried on Sunday. I was told by several doctors to get these vaccines. Now I wish I had followed my gut feeling and not gotten them at all. Sad says, I work in a hospital-like setting and was told the benefits outweigh the risks. I got the vaccine. 3 a.m. started bleeding and cramping. 3 p.m. miscarried. You decide. Sue says, I had the H1N1 vaccine, and 24 hours later, I had a miscarriage. And here's the last one that I'll be reading, but there are many. Linda says, my daughter-in-law was 10 weeks pregnant and had the H1N1 vaccine on Friday. That night, she miscarried. And it goes
right
on
now.
And
I just got a call. I just got a call from a woman last week whose baby survived. She had gotten the vaccine. Whose baby survived. The baby is now about 2 years old. I haven't talked to her yet, but her baby is autistic. Okay, so the survivors are now showing up autistic, and nobody's following that. And the interesting thing is Jim Moody, who's the attorney consultant for Safe Minds, sent me a document that he had sent to the CDC and all these everything else, showing he had FOIA'd emails that went on between the CDC regarding taking thimerosal out of vaccines.
I have to pick up my next guest. Eileen, you're welcome to stay on. I'm picking up Dr. Paul G. King right now.
Okay.
Okay,
welcome,
well, I'm
Dr.
here.
Paul G. King.
Hi there, I'm here.
Hi.
Well, I interrupted Eileen, but I didn't want to miss the pickup for fear that I would not be able to pick you up. Continue, okay. Eileen, and then we'll speak to Dr. King.
Okay, so Jim Moody sends me something that shows all the emails that went, not all the emails, but the emails that he found through FOIA between the people within the CDC concerning taking thimerosal out of the vaccines. And this was in 2000, this was a 2005 letter from Jim Moody. And it showed the dialogue between the inner people, the inside people of the CDC saying that, well, some of them were saying, you know, we should take thimerosal out right away because, you know, obviously this is causing a problem. Others said we can't take it out right away because we destroy the image of the vaccine program. And so that all this wonderful dialogue was going on. So this one woman, Dr. Leslie Ball was saying take it out of the vaccine. This other woman said, you know, just slowly take it out. And they had all these different, so they decided that they would take it out of the vaccine, but they would do it in such a way that at least they would only recommend it to children, to infants at 6 months old and 7 months old. So now the recommendations are infants since 2005, infants not younger than 6 months old, because anything younger, the weight ratio, the thimerosal could damage them, right? So with this information and with this recommendation and with this new protocol that only 6 months old would get their first flu vaccine, I ask you, why then would they recommend a flu shot? And they still recommend today, they recommend four shots, a flu shot, disregarding whether it had mercury in it or not, and a TDAP. Why would they recommend a flu shot for pregnant women when the fetus is of such a low birth weight, when they actually clearly decided that a child, an infant, should not get it until they're 6 months old because it's damaging? So here they have their recommendation at 6 months old and 7 months old, and yet they inject it into pregnant women in utero before this little baby is even, you know, the size of a thumb.
Well, Dr. Carley says that it says right in the text you never vaccinate a pregnant woman. So the whole thing is, if it's in their medical textbooks, how can they claim that other than that? Okay, welcome, Dr. Paul G. King.
Hi there.
Well, please tell us everything that you would like to say about the flu shot, because that is the emphasis with the new mandates here in New York City for the youngest.
Well, again, I don't approach this thing from anything besides what science is telling me. And the latest articles that have been published that bear on this issue directly show that two things. One, that it's not effective in, well, first of all, there are studies that show that for children under the age of two, it's totally non-effective. That's including their own studies, not, you know, the ones that are done by the people who are trying to show efficacy. So giving it to a child under 2 years of age is no effectiveness whatsoever that anybody can show by any kind of study, even the messed up ones they do, which look at the relative protection rates, not the absolute ones. However, there was a study that was done in 2012 by a group called Cowling et al., which talked about the increase of non-influenza respiratory virus infections associated with receipt of the inactivated influenza vaccine. This is the only gold study that I've ever found, which is double-blind. It has a true placebo-controlled component, and it has long-term, greater than 250-day follow-up to look at what happens as the outcomes. And one of the things they found was that there was no significant increase in protection. There was a statistical increase in protection by a slight amount, because, which is like 4% or less, because the two groups weren't equally sized. The people who ended up getting the flu vaccine were one-third larger in number than the people who didn't, but both of them absolutely had three flu cases on each group. Each group had three cases of flu, although there was a high difference in which strain. That's by flu, I mean influenza illness tied to a vaccine-related strain of influenza A or influenza B. But they also found that these children had a lot of other sicknesses, and in the other sicknesses, the children that were vaccinated had more than four times the risk than the placebo-injected children of subsequently developing a non-influenza viral respiratory infection. So not only did it not protect the ones who were vaccinated, but it also increased their risk they would be sick. Now, this was only a study of a few hundred, less than 200 people, so it's not really very big, so that's a problem. But there was a study that was done the year previously by a group called Kelly et al., and it was called Vaccine Effectiveness Against Laboratory-Confirmed Influenza in Healthy Young Children, a Case-Control Study. Now, this, again, is one of those pseudo-studies, because the cases were those people that got influenza that was laboratory-confirmed, and the controls were those who were vaccinated that didn't get influenza. And what they found was the same thing. They said, we don't understand why, but we're finding that the ones that are not getting influenza are much more likely to have gotten some other respiratory illness. Now, against all this background is an article by Doshi that was published in May of 2013, where he looked at, of flu cases, how many are influenza? You look back over the previous, like, 20 years' worth of data, and the answer is less than 20%. So the people talk about protection against against the flu, which means any influenza-like illness, when it can only provide protection against 5% or 10%, 5% actually, of the real cases which are influenza. The other 95% cases or something else. They make symptoms like it. It could be a bad cold. They could be a Coxsackie virus. They could be RSV. They could be anything. So this is one of the problems.
I would like to throw out three very short statements. The Swedish government just apologized to the populace for the narcolepsy the flu shot has brought about in the children. Secondly, 30,000 nurses have quit their jobs not to take the flu vaccine, according to Dr. Tenpenny. And thirdly, a friend of mine who works in the emergency room as a nurse here in New York City said in 2012, 90% of the people who came in with the flu had been inoculated against it. Please proceed, Dr. King.
Well, again, these are all consistent with what you would see. If you read the literature, it says if you get this vaccine, not only will it not protect you from, quote, flu, which is any influenza-like illness, it won't really protect you against influenza A, B, influenza A or influenza B much at all, if any, and it will increase your risk of having all these other diseases. And, of course, there are these side effects, which nobody wants to talk about.
And I do.
Eileen spent a long time talking about the ones with the fetal losses and whatever. But for another reason, there's somebody recently asked me the question about Guillain-Barré. Guillain-Barré is a rather significant adverse reaction, and it's been associated with the flu vaccine. And so I went and looked at all the reports, and what I did was a simple search of VAERS. Just give me by influenza season, not by year, but by influenza season, which is slightly different, offsets them because the years for influenza seasons are spread between two halves of 2 years. Influenza season versus the rate. And I had my friend Dr. Goldman actually printed up a graph of it, but the same spike that was seen in the fetal losses in 2009-10, there was a correspondingly spike in Guillain-Barré reports in that same influenza season, indicating to me that clearly. And another thing, when I was looking at this, I looked at all this data, and I noticed that, how shall we say, people had asked the question, you know, is it higher? And so I went and looked at all the data, just looking at, not only look at the total of the Guillain-Barré reports, but look at what percent of the reports for every year were flu-related. And it turned out that on average, 70% of the reports of Guillain-Barré were related to someone getting a flu vaccine. Now, unlike other vaccines where the vaccine is usually obtained, there's always some other vaccine that's being given, in the case of flu vaccine, there's not always some vaccine that's being given. So quite often, at least in half of the cases, the only vaccine to be given at the time is the influenza vaccine, and typically the Guillain-Barré reports occur slightly after. They're, quote, time-related, and the government would say, well, you know, time correlation doesn't mean it caused it. Excuse me, you know, if somebody fires a bullet at me and 15 seconds later I drop dead from a bullet wound, I think the bullet caused my death. So somebody sticks a flu shot in my arm, and a very short period of time later, I suddenly developed things. When I was originally healthy before, I suddenly developed this severe neurological condition, which is what Guillain-Barré is. It doesn't develop instantaneously. It starts, and the conditions get worse and worse at some point. And then for most people, it resolves, and after, in 2 or 3 or 4 years, they can get back to what they, when they relearn how to walk and talk and feed themselves and go to the bathroom and all that kind of stuff, they can get back to their normal lives. A few percent of the people who are affected, of course, die, and a few other percent, which are worse, are left vegetables forever. But some are left totally vegetables, so they don't even have conscious capability of knowing what's going on, but a few, which are probably the worst, are left with these totally, they're quadriplegics with a fully functioning mind. Now, that probably is the worst from a human being's point of view. The government says that the rate of Guillain-Barré related to influenza vaccines is on the order of 1 to 2 in a million doses. Well, I looked at the reports to VAERS, which, you know, reports to VAERS are typically no more than 10% of the reports, and quite often 1% of the reports were things that are rare and very dangerous. And if you assume the 1% reporting, the numbers that I found, based upon what they claimed, were just the doses that were distributed. That doesn't mean they were all used, but doses that were distributed and not returned for the period from 1990 to 2012-13, which I could find data for, that those numbers, if you assume 1% whatever, the per dose, per million doses rate would be somewhere in the order of, I'll look to see what the lowest one is. It's 30-some-odd. Let's just say 35, or 33 is the actual lowest one. 183. So for every million doses they give, they're really having something on the order of between 30 and 183 cases a year, depending on the year, because some vaccines are more dangerous than others for reasons we don't quite understand. It's not like one vaccine, you keep giving it over and over again, there's only one rate. Another critical problem with flu vaccines in particular is a condition nobody seems to think is very important. It's called vasculitis, and that's inflammation of the vascular system. And at least in one hospital system that I've had somebody give me some idea what was going on, they have a quality group. Most hospitals have a quality group to look to see what's going on, how outcomes of surgery and things like that. Well, in their cardiovascular surgery unit, after they started giving flu shots to all the patients on admissions, they had having a much higher problem rate because you got people with inflamed arteries. You're operating on them. How wonderful is that? And the hospital didn't seem to get it. They could continue the policy. They didn't seem to be wanting to stop or change it. But this is insane to give sick people or people are going to be operated on a vaccine on admission that might contribute to the killing of them, unless your goal is to kill off people, which case I guess it's a good thing to do, right? If your goal is to reduce the population, what the heck? And it's just, you know, it's just a coincidence. The guy had surgery and he died. It's all people have surgery and die all the time. But if you get a flu shot, apparently it was increasing the risk significantly enough that the quality data was skewing upward once they started getting flu shots on admission in that hospital. So here you have the greatest boondoggle in American history. You're giving, this is snake oil at its finest. You're giving a vaccine that doesn't work, people to get sicker from other things. And then you hear the wonderful government saying recently, oh, we did a study and we claimed this effectiveness percentage. Forget about that. They come and then say it's effective for brain inflammation and all these other, and pneumonia and whatever. Excuse me? I'm stupid, but I didn't know you get a flu vaccine to protect yourself from brain inflammation, which is usually caused by things besides flu.
I would like to read you a list of the reactions to the flu zone vaccine, and and if you'd like to expand on that, I'd appreciate it. One is abnormally low platelet count. Another one is Guillain-Barré. Another one is myelitis. Another is optic neuritis,
which is
inflammation of the optic nerve. And then there's an enlarged lymph nodes, facial palsy, which is Bell's palsy, numbness, tingling of the skin, itchy skin, anaphylaxis, which is life-threatening whole-body allergic reaction, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, vasculitis, which is inflammatory destruction of blood vessels, difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, chest pain. Brachial neuritis, which is excruciating unilateral shoulder pain followed by paralysis of shoulder, pharyngitis and rhinitis, inflammation of the throat or pharynx and the nose respectively, and convulsions, fainting, and dizziness.
Well, these are all showing your immune system is having a very strong reaction of some sort to being stimulated, and the reactions aren't positive. And typically, the more you get these reactions, the worse the conditions will get, the bigger your risk will become. We all have a very wide range of immune systems, thank goodness, or else you'd be dropping all of us like flies. And so everybody reacts to a vaccine assault differently. Some people, the first dose they ever get is the last dose they ever get because it kills them. Some people, the first dose they get is doesn't cause any effect whatsoever, and they can get lots and lots of doses for several years, and all of a sudden they start developing problems.
If it doesn't get you right away, it'll get you over the long run. But what I would like to make a comment in regard to Dr. Haley's assessment, which is one vaccine to a 6-pound infant would be the equivalent of 30 on the same day to 180 pounds.
Well, that just has to do with the difference in weight. Actually, that's not a true comparison. If anything, it's worse than that, but that's a way of looking at it. The difference is that really children are more resistant because their immune system isn't working at all, so it tends to not respond. You have to understand, in the normal way of humans are supposed to be raised, they're supposed to be breastfed until they're between 2 and 3 years of age, on average, if their mothers can do that. And that while they're being breastfed, the breastfeeding initially takes over all the functioning of the immune system. It provides all the immunity they need. It's it has the breast milk initially has a factor in the milk which actually is cancer cell killing, actually. It provides all sorts of other things which nourish the good bacteria in the gut and suppress the bad ones. It provides
you
all sorts of immune factors.
You have 1 minute left, Dr. King. Would you like to refer people to a website to further investigate this?
Oh, well, if they want to read what I have to say about much about vaccines, they can read my website. It's www.dr-king.com. And they'll find that I write on a variety of subjects and try to answer what people